Welcome to the Podium and Panel Podcast.
Good afternoon, Your Honors.
What's at the end of this case? How did this come about? Are you in the pay of the Microsoft Corporation?
Sure, with the text of the Second Amendment.
Your Honor, I think that could be viewed as political, that would be...
How about the First Amendment?
No, Your Honor, I don't think the First Amendment...
You're out again. Still out.
I think we're all textual.
Welcome to episode 201 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. Here's to the next 200 and a rare sighting. I'm in Chicago today taping and will be for the next several weeks. No planned travel for at least the next several weeks, so that's good. First case today is from the Illinois Appellate 5th District, Mogensen versus SCF Lewis and Clark Fleeting LLC. The second is from the Supreme Court of the United States, Fisher versus United States. And the third is from the Illinois Appellate 5th as well, Davis versus Southern Illinois Hospital Services. Turning to our first case, do you prepare trial witnesses with reference to the trial testimony of prior witnesses? If so, you may want to reconsider that practice in Illinois. In Mogensen versus CSF, Lewis and Clark Fleeting LLC, the Illinois Appellate Court, 5th District, will consider whether it was proper for the trial court to strike the pleadings of the defendant where defense counsel briefed a witness about other witnesses' testimony in violation of Illinois Rule of Evidence 615. Does the court even have to enter an order sequestering witnesses, or is Rule 615 self-executing? What is the proper standard of review by the appellate court where the defendant claims that the order sequestering the witnesses is unclear? And we'll talk about the rule later. The striking of the pleadings led to a consideration by the jury of the issues on damages alone and a verdict in the amount of $3 million. Pat, tell us about this case and something I hadn't really ever thought about.
And that makes two of us. And I try a lot more cases than you do, although I don't try very many. I think it's best to start with the rule. So Rule 615 says, at the request of a party, the court shall order witnesses excluded so they cannot hear the testimony of the witnesses and may make the order of its own motion. This rule does not authorize exclusion of a party who is a natural person or an officer or employee of a party which is not a natural person designated as its representative or a person whose presence is shown by a party to be essential to the presentation of the party's cause or a person authorized by law to be present. Now, the way I read that rule is they can't be present. Not that they can't know about what was testified to. In this case, the witness was not present, but he was, quote, briefed, was the word that he used, by defense counsel about what happened, about what the testimony of other witnesses were. And the way this came to light at the oral argument was apparently plaintiff's counsel, who was also arguing for the appellee, apparently his first question on cross-examination was, someone talked to you about the prior testimony of the witnesses? And the witness answered yes. And then they got into how he had been briefed about what the other witnesses had testified to. He had been briefed as to what they had said. And the plaintiff's attorney said, you know, that this witness had been thoroughly coached, but apparently not coached well enough not to hide the coaching. So there's coaching and there's coaching. And this wasn't very good coaching, apparently. And the trial judge was none too happy with this. I think I got the indication that neither was at least Justice Cates when her first question after the lawyer corrected her on the pronunciation of his name, and before he began his presentation was, were you trial counsel? Because if he had been, I think the argument might have gone differently for him. I'm not sure I even know who the other two justices on the panel were because they didn't ask any questions, as often happens in an argument when she is sitting, even whether she's the presiding justice or not. You don't know because she asks so many questions. She is the bench. As you say, sometimes if a guy is really big, he is the offensive line. Dan, you'll appreciate that, having been on the offensive line, my cousin being an offensive lineman. He is the offensive line. My cousin, who's 6'7", who played at 6'7", about 320, was a guard. And they do a thing at Virginia Tech where they walk up the hill about a couple hours before the game. And the parents and fans can greet the families can greet the players before they go into the football house to change and get ready. And the guy he played next to was called Big John. He made my cousin look small. John was 6'8", 6'9", 360 or 70. I mean, he was the offensive line. He was a giant human that my cousin played next to and made my cousin look small. It was pretty funny. I've never seen that happen before. I saw it happen the Saturdays I went up and watched him play, which weren't as many as I would have liked in retrospect. But anyway, the trial court was also not pleased with defense counsel in this case and struck the pleadings, the most severe sanction that could have been undertaken, and left them with no defenses to liability. Dan, other than knowing that this has something to do with the Jones Act, I have no idea what the underlying facts are from the oral argument. All I know is about the sanction and this misconduct. So
me either.
The other part about this is that the order is allegedly unclear. Now, plaintiff's counsel in his presentation said, hold it now. You guys asked for the sequestering order. It's a standard motion to eliminate most parties. Both parties usually present as the sequester witnesses. I honestly have to say I've never... Now, let me say, this is distinct from talking to the witness while they're on the stand. You take a break or whatever, you know, for lunch or for folks to use the bathroom, what have you. And you can't talk to them then while they're still testifying. Fine. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about a witness who has not yet testified and being briefed on what the other witnesses have said at trial. And I just read the rule. Dan, does the rule say anything about not talking to them? It says they can't be present. It doesn't say you can't talk to them about what other people have said.
No, it's. This, if it stands, this is to me astounding in some ways. I don't know how you can prep for. How would you prep an expert witness, for example?
Well, you would do it with the discovery stuff.
Well, I know, so, but still, but you. But what you with do, those, you talk about what has been testified to, right? And they look at records and well.
Well, no, but not so. The way it, I posted about this yesterday, and one lawyer, she commented, you know, this. I did this the other day or trial recently, and I know how that trial turned out. They won the trial, very big win for them. She posted, you post it in the hypothetical. You say on the stand they haven't prepped, and you say if a witness testified to X in this case, what would be your response? Something along these lines. If it were said this, would this assist or bolster your opinion? Or what impact would this have on your opinion? What would your reaction be to this testimony if it were given? This kind of a thing. And that's how you do it. But you can't prep them for it with what was said. And I don't know how, I mean, the cardinal rule of trying a case is you don't ask questions you don't know the answer to. These are to your own witnesses. And you've got to be very careful how you prep them. I will say this, the court and plaintiff's counsel and defense counsel seem to take what was done here as given as being wrong. The defense lawyer said it was one time as opposed to multiple times. The defense lawyer said, you know, this is too harsh a sanction. This kind of thing. It wasn't contumacious. It wasn't, you know, he's arguing the scope of the sanction fitting the crime. There was no dispute that the rule was violated. Okay, I that's news to me, and so maybe I should try more cases or not. But when I do, I won't be doing this because this is. And I think back to cases I've tried. I'm not sure if I've done this or not. I honestly don't know. I honestly don't know. But yeah. I hope I haven't. Now I know not to. And if I'm an ignoramus, perhaps I have exposed that too. Dan, any further thoughts on this case, which is really kind of scary?
It is kind of scary. Again, it's just I wonder even in some of those situations you talked about with hypotheticals, even if you were doing that for your witnesses, non-expert witnesses, would that violate the rule?
Well, if you're doing it during trial, you're doing it in front of everybody. You're not doing it outside the presence. Then that's okay. I think that's the way around.
But how do you prep? I mean, how do you prep a witness? You know, prepping witnesses again. I don't try enough cases either. But to me, this seems like a pretty scary proposition. If this is how it really is interpreted.
Yeah, I agree. It's we'll see what happens and what the court has to say. How this turns out. So with that, we'll take our first break and come back with Fisher versus United States.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiumandpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podium and Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
We're back for segment 2 of episode 201 of the Podium and Panel Podcast. And what work is otherwise, the word otherwise, doing in the blow or in this statute? That, and not the events of January 6th and whether Donald Trump will or will not be helped by the outcome is the issue in Fisher versus United States. The statute provides whoever corruptly, one, alters, destroys, mutilates, or conceals a record, document, or other object, or attempts to do so with the intent to impair the object's integrity or availability for use in an official proceeding, or two, otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes an official proceeding or attempts to do so, shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 20 years or both. Dan, tell us about the word otherwise.
Yeah, very important case. And one of the things I think Perloger talked about is that they charged 1,350 people or something like that of January 6th crimes, and 350, I think, were under this statute provision. And
including Donald Trump.
Including Donald Trump, but there's also a number of other counts that he's been indicted under. But yeah, this is one of them.
This is the only felony for him.
Yeah,
the others are misdemeanors.
Yeah, and what the Fisher counsel said is that this court has said it otherwise. When using a criminal statute, it means to do similar conduct in a different way. And again, I think what's going to come down here is if you're really using textualism, otherwise the second provision you read, Pat, talks about different things than the first one. But in other criminal statutes, as was argued here by, again, Fisher's counsel, at least, the word otherwise is not broad. It's kind of limiting, and it kind of leads to things that are otherwise enumerated in the statutory provisions. And that was, I think, Chief Justice Roberts' position. But this is a big event because, as you mentioned, this is the only felony, or in other cases where people have been charged with other felonies, what's this otherwise in this provision that you read, Pat, would do is it has the most severe criminal penalties of any of the statutes that anybody's charged with. It gets up to 20 years in prison, and I think some of the justices were skeptical that that this is not, number one, this has never been used before. This law was enacted in light of Sarbanes-Oxley back in the early 2000s after a bunch of failures in the financial system.
This is directly related to Enron.
To Enron.
And Arthur Anderson.
Yeah, and MCI and all the other things that came out of those times. As I mentioned, you know, some of the justices in this case were, I think, concerned that if the government was right in this case and you could apply this law, it would sweep in too much conduct. Others, you know, some of the liberal justices and perhaps a few others talked about the fact that this seemed to be a catch-all phrase. And again, the language that you read, Pat, was the first part, C1, talks about alters, destroys, mutilates, or conceals a record document. And again, that's, like you said, the Enron thing. That's the, back in the day, there was a Miller Lite commercial, I think, at the Super Bowl, where it looked like it was snowing, and then they panned out, and it was the top of the roof, and it was a bunch of people in a shred party pouring documents over the side of the building. The interesting thing about Enron is that Enron's conviction was overturned unanimously by the court, by the Rehnquist court, due to errors in jury instructions. And so there you have it. But it was too late for Enron and for Arthur Andersen in particular. But again,
That's the Skilling case, right?
Yeah, Skilling. But again, the second prong of this, C2, says otherwise obstructs, influences, or impedes any official proceeding or attempts to do so. So, and again, that was intended to be when the SEC came calling and investigated it, maybe the FBI, and there was alleged attempts to do those things to interfere with the investigation. The arguments were more than 2 hours, and I think, you know, one of the things here we talk about sometimes, Pat, is the advocates, Paul Clement. We've talked about extensively. This was a guy by the name of Green, and he really, I think, did a nice job in rebuttal of talking about what a precedent here might do to future cases. He referred to Prologar, who we've noted as an excellent advocate, that she seemed to agree that Section 1512 C2 could apply to peaceful protests as long as prosecutors could show the intent that was necessary here, and that his final argument was that the federal government wants to unleash a potential 20-year sentence on peaceful protesters. And again, you can debate whether these people were peaceful protesters or not, but that's not the issue here. The issue here, again, is really one of statutory interpretation and looking at this language. And as I mentioned, Pat, one of the things that I think some of the justices, at least Roberts for sure, and I think Kavanaugh and several others, really made clear is that in other criminal statutes, the word otherwise is used, and it's not a catch-all. And some of this argument reminds me, I may have mentioned this on the show before, Pat, but years ago I was in front of Judge Lichtenstein, and affirmative defenses, there's a catch-all phrase, there's like 8 or 9 enumerated affirmative defenses in the Illinois Code, and then there's any other claim or defense you may have. And so historically, if you look at case law, attorneys have used, you know, other things, right? Because that seems to be like a catch-all. And his pushback on that was that that's not the way that it's read, that catch-all was really intended to be anything related to the 8 or 9 things that had been enumerated in the statute. And no matter on briefing and stuff, even though we brought cases in and stuff, that was his position. So I think this will be an interesting case to see how, you know, the one person I think that in recent terms, and we've talked about some of the cases, Pat, that may be a surprise here, it might be Gorsuch again, because Gorsuch and his textualism, if he's looking at otherwise and he looks at the language of C1 and C2 here, will he find that otherwise is limiting here, or will he find that it's a catch-all? I think we may see him write an opinion, however it comes out. I'm speculating there. I have no idea. But as we know, Pat, the Supreme Court ended its oral arguments last week, and they have about 40
with another Trump case.
In another Trump case, but they have about 42 opinions to get out in the next 6 weeks or whatever, the 7-8 weeks maybe. And so this will be one that's probably a bifurcated decision, I would think. And we'll see where it ends up and who writes it. Interesting issues of statutory interpretation. And depending on how this case comes out, it could have a large impact on some of the January 6th cases that are pending. So stay tuned.
So several things. First, I want to pick up on your mention of Justice Gorsuch, because I was going to go there too, but for a different purpose. What may inform his decision, inform his thinking, and I don't know if it came up in the argument, correct me if I'm wrong, I may have missed it or I forgot about it, is a doctrine that he is a fan of and has cited, and that is the rule of lenity. And another fan of the rule of lenity is Justice Brown Jackson. She's a fan of the rule of lenity. And I think that application of that rule would plainly favor the petitioner here. So that may be a way to say, yes, this is what the text says in terms of it being a catch-all, but we're going to construe it in favor of the defendant and you can't get them. That would be a way in which the rule of lenity might work out if it's applied. Do you recall it being mentioned at argument? I do not.
I don't think it was. I'd be very surprised if
they didn't make the argument in the briefs. Yeah. It certainly would have been, for the very reason that you say, I was kind of surprised not to hear it. It seems to be the kind of argument I would make in a case like this to at least try to get to pick off Gorsuch because you have no idea where he's going to end up. He is one that is, when he applies textualism, is entirely unmoored from his political priors. He Alito, we can't say that sometimes, but certainly with Gorsuch, we can say he will come to an outcome that he believes is textually correct, even if it doesn't comport with his policy preference. I don't know what his policy preference would be here, but his party preference might be. I can tell what that would be. Lenity may be an issue that we should take a look at. Another thing, I was listening to a podcast talking about this, and they brought up corpus linguistics. And there's, as you can imagine, many amicus briefs. One amicus brief that doesn't favor either side is from some law professors who used corpus linguistics. If you're unfamiliar with that, that is a using large language models to review, as the name suggests, the corpus of how words are used in this way when they are or are not followed by a verb. And in this case, otherwise is followed by a verb. And in this case, the corpus linguistics scholars came out saying that the way in which the word is used favors the government, not the the petitioner. We'll see. I think it's important to say that both the district court and the D.C. Circuit held in favor of the government in this case. So that as indicated by who did rebuttal, it's the petitioner is the criminal defendant. One of many people, as Dan articulated, charged with crimes on January 6th. And this particularly is arising out of the attempt to obstruct the vote counting process or the certification process that is mandated. And so we'll see what happens, how this gets interpreted, and the result that it will have. Not only for this individual, but for a lot of other individuals, and then also for Donald Trump potentially.
If this were to happen again.
Or something like it. I mean, this statute has never been applied outside of the financial crime type context.
Right.
This could apply to. Now, you mentioned peaceful protest. That's one thing I want to mention is a peaceful protest. I think what modifies all of that is corruptly at the very beginning. Whoever corruptly, I find it. No one's arguing that what the focus is on otherwise, not on the corruptly.
Right.
Although I think there could be an argument about corruptly. That isn't the argument. That isn't the issue here as to whether they were peaceful or not on January 6th. I'll take for the purposes of this line of argument it wasn't peaceful. Fine. Does that mean it's corrupt? I don't know. I don't know what corruptly means. It doesn't say violently. I don't think corruptly necessarily means violently.
No, I don't either.
It's certainly nothing good. I will agree with that. But I don't know if it necessarily involves violently. But that isn't the issue here.
Again, this is intended for Sarbanes-Oxley arena.
Yep.
And so, those are material misstatements. The corruptness, it's almost a RICO-like on the financial side. I mean, that's the kind of context of that, I think. So again,
it's a very good fit for what it was trying to get at.
Yeah.
Is it a fit for this?
Right.
Especially in light, another issue that came up was there, they said, well, this is the catch-all. Well, there's another catch-all. How many catch-alls does the government need?
Right.
And that was one of the points that the more liberal justices made. It's like, hold it. They've got, you know, they're trying to sweep in as much conduct as they can because they can't conceive of all the different ways in which people can commit crimes of this kind. They plainly are trying to sweep up as much as they can. This conduct fits into this, and therefore it's covered. But one of the points the petitioner makes is, hold it, you're rendering this other catch-all phrase a dead letter. So
right.
Which that's certainly a textual point is surplusage. So that could be another way that the textualists on the court go and say, hold it, if we read it this way, we render this other provision surplus. Now there's responses to that. Surplus isn't dispositive. Certainly sometimes we've all written contracts and sometimes you say something more than once. How you interpret contracts is how you interpret legislation usually, or statutes usually. And sometimes there's surplusage. Sometimes you say it twice, three times to make sure it's clear. Insurance policies certainly do that on occasion. But the surplus canon may come up too. It's not the most powerful of canons, but it certainly is one. So anything else to add, Dan, on that?
Nope. I think we've covered it.
So with that, we'll take our next break and come back with a covenant not to compete.
Hey, Podiumin Podcast listeners. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can drop us a line at podiuminpanelpodcast@gmail.com. Please let us know about cases you're interested in or guests you'd like us to interview. You can also follow Dan and I on LinkedIn, as well as the Podiumin Panel Podcast page on LinkedIn. We look forward to hearing from you.
We're back for segment 3 of episode 201 of the Podiumin Panel Podcast. Non-compete agreements, if you've been paying any attention, have been in the news lately. This last week was before the Illinois Appellate Court, 5th District, in Davis versus Southern Illinois Hospital Services. The court will consider whether a letter from the employer purporting to prematurely terminate the agreement between it and the doctor was anticipatory repudiation, excusing the doctor's performance, or whether the party's continued performance and the expiration of the agreement to its natural termination date. The court will also consider whether the circuit court correctly determined that the non-compete agreement that limited the doctor to practice more than 25 miles or more than 2 years was unenforceable. The appellant contended that the court did not go through the entire analysis of the three factors from the Illinois Supreme Court in Reliable Fire Equipment Company versus Arredondo, 2011, L111871, that the agreement, one, is no greater than is required for the protection of a legitimate business interest of the employer promisee, two, does not impose undue hardship on the employee promisor, and three, is not injurious to the public. Pat, tell us about this case.
Thanks, Dan. This is obviously apropos of the FTC having banned, I think, is it all non-compete agreements, which will be a subject of a forthcoming episode of the Podiumin Panel Podcast in the year 2026.
Right.
When the lawsuits were filed the afternoon, the first lawsuit was filed the afternoon. In other words, they had this one ready to go. They knew this was coming.
It was coming by a 3-2 vote of the FTC.
The FTC was busy this week. They also brought back net neutrality. The FCC.
Yeah, the
alphabet
too.
Agencies were very busy.
These acronyms were generalists.
Exactly.
Easterbrook.
Thank you, Judge Easterbrook. They've been very busy. In the waning days of administration, they catch up all the shit they hadn't done before. It happens in Republican. It happens in Democrat. This is not a political valence to this. This is what happens. They've been building. It's like, oh shoot, we might lose in November. Quick, get all the garbage out the door. And this is what's going on. Midnight regulations. It's a great way to run a country. Not so much, but it's how we run a country. In any event, so we have this. notwithstanding that rule, because that doesn't apply to this situation, this doctor, and I'm not sure what his specialty was. It was unclear to me what his specialty was, but he's obviously got a group of patients and he wants to take them. The agreement seemed, or the relationship seemed, to have broken down. And the hospital sent him a letter that said, hey, we're going to fire you, or I'm going to renew the thing. This is 120 days. Well, we're going to cancel the agreement in 120 days. Now, the agreement was going to expire on its own terms in 150 days. So I'm not sure what the point was of this letter. And then the lawyer for the hospital, or the lawyer for the doctor, is like, well, it was an anticipatory repudiation, but then they both continued to perform. So you didn't treat it like an anticipatory repudiation because no one actually repudiated the agreement. They acted under it and then it was over. And then he went across the street, and not across the street literally, but went to another hospital within the area, and the court held that it wasn't an enforceable agreement because it didn't go through the entire analysis, was the argument. It's quite the situation. There was one that came out. There's an opinion that came out recently that I'm going to post about tomorrow from the Indiana Appellate Court, almost identical. Called Kessler versus Indiana University Hospital, where this doctor, the doctor in that case, has a unique procedure, surgical procedure for treating certain kinds of cancer cells in people's chests. And he has a network of 150 referring doctors. In other words, this guy's really good and people think he's really good performing this kind of surgery. And the court in that case did not uphold the agreement because it was, among other things, injurious to the public because he couldn't service the patients. So the court sent it back. The trial court enforced it, but the appellate court reversed, holding that the public would be harmed if this doctor were not able to provide these services because he's very good at his job. And so the non-compete agreements, it's a bit different when you're talking about highly skilled, trained professionals with millions of dollars in business, as opposed to the non-compete agreement for the Jimmy John's worker. The Jimmy John's worker doesn't have anything special. Anyone can make the sandwich or deliver the sandwich, or slice the bread. That's nothing special here. Not to insult Jimmy John's workers, but there's just nothing special about this. But the doctor who has the specialized knowledge, you know, it's a different position, and certainly is in a position to negotiate. If this is one of the terms of the employment that the doctor wants, they're in a position to negotiate that. Whereas the Jimmy John's worker doesn't have that kind of ability. So I certainly understand the argument that non-compete agreements have been employed way too broadly to cover jobs, and it's hard to call being a maker of sandwiches a profession, but professions that have no earthly business needing a non-compete agreement. Now, Dan, we're lucky. We're lawyers, and lawyers write the law, so no non-compete agreements for us. We at least in Illinois, I think there are some states where it's allowed. New York, that was an issue.
A small number.
Yeah, it was an issue in New York. It's allowed in New York, and that was an issue in Suits. I actually watched Suits when it was on, not when it got put on Netflix. So this is going back years. There was a whole thing. They had non-compete. I'm going, what do you mean non-compete? They're lawyers.
Although that show, who knows how much of it was actually
real. Sure. So I had to look it up. And I think my conclusion was that it was allowed in New York. Because I was like, this entire thing is hokey. You can't do that. That's nonsense. Like everything else in that show. The show is just beyond ridiculous.
It is, but it's a great show.
It's a soap opera with lawyers. And so it went very fancy offices with good views. And basketball's in one of the guys' offices.
Yeah.
But for some reason, don't fade with the sun. I don't understand how this basketball. You don't put the basketball out in the sun where it could be, you know, destroyed. But anyway, my pickings with suits run deep.
Me too.
So anyway, an interesting case, or certainly applicable to the current situation and law that is going to we're going to hear a lot about, and we'll have a future episode on whether this was administrative overreach of one kind or another. It seems to me quite clear that it's gross overreach, but that's what people in dark robes will decide.
Yeah.
Dan, anything to add on the Davis case?
No, it's it's an interesting thing. I once had a non-compete. It was a guy who fixed cars, I believe it was. I think that's what it was. And he had a non-compete in his that was 100 miles in radius, which is just, again, that pretty much puts him as an hourly worker out of business, because 100 miles from Chicago is Wisconsin. It's, you know, you can
well south of I-80.
Yeah, you can get to Ottawa, you know, Illinois or something in 100 miles. Yeah. You'd almost drive all of 88 west.
Yeah, the doctors in these cases, one was 25 miles and the one in Indiana was 30 miles.
Yeah.
So, you know, these doctors, they're very portable. You can go anywhere. You know, there's a lot of places that have the facilities to do what this doctor was doing.
Yeah.
And so it's,
and it's 100 like you
miles,
said,
my goodness, that's crazy.
And one of the challenges, I think, in those lawsuits that were filed against the FTC's new rule is they use Rule 5, which is a rule that's been used, if you look at the FTC's website, on advertising, on privacy. It's their enforcement powers, and there's nothing in there about employment or non-compete. So it'll be interesting to see. Like you said, it's probably overreach for sure. And like you said, in 2026 or so, if we're doing the podcast then, episode 300 or 400, we'll be talking about the skepticism of the court in terms of this law and rule.
Indeed, and they're trying to get this done prior to Chevron, whatever happens with Chevron,
right?
In the Loper,
which could have an impact here too.
Reckless,
so, yeah,
which may have an impact, exactly.
Yeah.
So
interesting.
All right. So with that, we have our BI BIPA GIPA IPA. Dan, one case, I think it was a Third Circuit case
that
Ralph Lauren on its stay of COVID appeal was lifted, and they can now proceed with their case. Didn't see that coming, but there it is.
And again, all that means is that they're still at the early stages. So as we've talked about before on these cases, it doesn't mean that they won. It just means that they can pursue it and see if they can prove that there's property damage or other things to their stores and things of that nature.
Right. Again, this week, no predictions. No cases. So Dan stands at 308.63-24. I am 305.66-24. So let's do our predictions for this week. We've got Morganson versus SCF Lewis and Clark. I think that gets affirmed.
I think so.
Fisher versus United States gets reversed, I think.
I think it gets reversed.
And Davis versus Southern Illinois, I think that gets affirmed.
I think it gets affirmed. I think that's right.
Okay. Outstanding. Which brings us to our rule of the week. Dan, why don't you introduce this?
Sure. And we talked a little bit about 615, Pat. There's another case that you posted on last week, Sanders versus CXS. In that case, the defense tried to use a former employee as a corporate representative who had been president at the council table despite exclusionary Rule 615. Tell us about that case and 615 and this corporate representative rule.
Thanks, Dan. And I read the rule earlier, and I kind of skipped over this part of it because it wasn't applicable to the case we were discussing. But it's very applicable to this situation, where what the defendants did was they had a former employee who was a current employee when he testified at discovery deposition, but he was former employee by the time they got to trial, and no one knew that until he got to trial. And there's no issue about there being a sequestration, and they argued, hey, we can have this witness be our representative, and he sits at council table. Well, the rule says this rule does not apply, or sorry, does not authorize exclusion of to an officer or an employee of a party which is not a natural person designated as the representative by its attorney. In other words, only current officers or employees of a party can be the designated representative. And so the court struck the testimony of this witness because he had not been properly sequestered. I haven't seen sequestration cases in quite a while. We've had two in the last of recent vintage.
Yeah.
And on very nuanced, well, this isn't so nuanced. This is kind of right out of the rule. They tried to argue that they could do this and the court just wasn't buying it. The question again is, what's the, is the sanction appropriate to allow, you know, to do this? It seems that either the lawyers weren't aware of the rule, which they can be forgiven. I was unaware of the rule being this specific. I am now. But also the, whether the sanction was appropriate, under the circumstances, or did they try to get over, did they know the rule and they were trying to get over and hope no one noticed? Well, people noticed, it turns out. Opposing counsel noticed and the judge noticed, and that didn't go well. So, and this is a case involving a combination of asbestos and glyphosate and other diesel fumes causing cancer in an employee. It's a FELA case. And the defendants actually didn't do that bad because under FELA, I didn't know this, the plaintiff was found to be 65% at fault because his cancer, they found, was related to his smoking that he was told to stop. So he had colon cancer, and the smoking can cause the colon cancer, but they only found, so that they were only hit for like $700,000, based upon a 65% reduction from the $3 million or so that was assessed as the value because of his contribution, because apparently under FELA, you can be more than 50% at fault and the worker still can recover. You just reduce it to the percentage of the worker's contribution to the cancer. How the jury arrives at the various ways in which, how anyone could arrive at, well, he smoked, he was exposed to asbestos, he was exposed to glyphosate, and he was exposed to diesel. And out of all that, we say the smoking caused 65. I don't understand how you could possibly expect anyone to ascertain that, but that's what they did. And
I do.
It's kind of wild. But the point here is that your corporate representative actually has to be an employee of the corporation. Shouldn't be complicated, but apparently it was. So with that, Dan, we'll take our leave. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. We'll see you next week on the Podium and Panel podcast.
I'm Dan Cotter, and on behalf of my co-host, Pat Eckler, we thank you for listening and look forward to having you join us again. Please follow us on LinkedIn and read our columns in the Chicago Daily Law Bulletin. Please join us again at the Podium and Panel. Each episode on the Podium and Panel podcast, we will cover several oral arguments and decisions in civil matters at the Illinois Appellate Court and Illinois Supreme Court, with the occasional coverage of SCOTUS and other appellate courts. The purpose of the podcast is to inform of developments that may affect business and are not to be considered legal advice. They do not create a lawyer-client relationship. Information on previous case results do not guarantee a similar future result. The opinions are their own and do not reflect those of the firms for which they work or their clients.